Ah, yes. If it's the dulcet tones of Led Zeppelin, specifically Kashmir, then, of course, it must be time for us to talk with the KYMN National Security Correspondent, former Navy Commander, former host of National Security This Week, current Carleton professor, and just all-around good guy. Good morning, John Olson. How are you?
I'm doing fine, sir. How about yourself?
I'm well. Thanks.
John, we're so glad to have you here. But, Rich, I have to say something. You cannot play that intro song for John and say dulcet.
You're right.
That just doesn't vibe, man.
That's absolutely true.
When I hear that song, I picture Robert Downey Jr. in Iron Man just like walking out, sunglasses in suit. And that's what I want for John. I want John to that great visual for our listeners.
Well, you know, the song has great gravitas, as does John Olson.
We have to come up with a better word than dulcet.
Okay, I'll figure it out. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. I'll relay a quick little story to the two of you and to our listeners. One of the classes I'm teaching at Carleton right now is called Intelligence Methods in National Security.
Okay.
And we're taking a look at how the U.S. National Security Council functions, how the National Security Advisor guides the staff in taking a look at issues happening around the world, and how the intelligence cycle is used to, you know, drive collection requirements that feed information up to the National Security Council so they can advise the president appropriately on what's happening in the world and possible courses of action.
Mm-hmm.
And a week ago, we had established that the crisis that we were going to manage notionally within our course was the India-Pakistan tensions after the terrorist attack up in Kashmir 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So I had all the students submit, you know, a couple of pages worth of detailed intelligence collection requirements that they would want to know about what was happening between India and Pakistan. And we were reviewing those yesterday afternoon,
wow,
considering all of the ramifications of this situation, when newsflash came across our screens that India had just carried out airstrikes against Pakistani militant camps up in Kashmir. I mean, it's like, this
okay
is unbelievable. The timing of this is unbelievable. So it was a great learning opportunity for the students as we were, you know, deeply discussing this whole situation, and then bam, it unfolds right in real time for us. So
for those who haven't opened their newspaper yet this morning, get us caught up on what's going on between India and Pakistan.
So 2 weeks ago, there were, I think, 26 people killed up in Kashmir. There were Indian tourists. I think one person was a Nepalese tourist. And they were killed by what was assumed to be Pakistani separatist groups, you know, Kashmiri separatists who are backed by Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
And so India said, you know, we're going to carry out a response when we're ready. And yesterday afternoon, our time, they carried out a bunch of airstrikes in Pakistani-controlled parts of Kashmir and even inside Pakistan in what the Indian intelligence referred to as terrorist training camps or recruitment facilities, et cetera, things along those lines. Now, one of the people that they were specifically trying to get was the head of one of the Kashmiri separatist groups.
Mm-hmm.
It was, this guy has sort of been on their most wanted list for quite some time. And I guess about 10 members of his family were killed, but they missed him.
Whoops.
I mean, unfortunately, when these things happen, you know, airstrikes that are carried out in a counterterrorism operation, it's very rare that you actually succeed in getting, you know, the principles that you're going after.
Yeah.
Usually it's a lot of collateral damage, unfortunately. So,
Islamabad has declared that to be an act of war.
Well, it is. I mean, there have been, you know, a whole bunch of things that have happened between India and Pakistan, you know, going all the way back to 1948. Right.
Yeah, right.
And right now, the thing that really is the burr under the saddle for both sides of this issue are both countries claim control over the whole Kashmir region.
Mm-hmm.
And India, I think, controls more of the region than Pakistan does. India has a larger military. Mm-hmm. But both sides have nuclear weapons, which means that escalation of conflict that happens up in that area is disconcerting, to say the least.
Yeah.
So the area of Pakistan, or the area of Kashmir that Pakistan controls, if your listeners were to look on a map, right, say go to Google Maps.
Yes.
There's this sort of dotted line area on the eastern side of Jammu and Kashmir, and there's a thing called the line of control that goes through there, and that's Pakistani forces on the west side and Indian forces on the east side of that line.
Okay.
Most of it is through really high mountainous terrain. A number of years ago, along that line of control in an area called Kargil, there was a serious dust-up between the Indian and Pakistani militaries over that area. This attack that the Indians carried out yesterday was really the first major strikes that have happened between the two countries in quite some time. But that area that Pakistan controls, the capital of their area of Kashmir that they control, is an area called Muzaffarabad, which is only about 20 miles away from Abbottabad,
right.
Pakistan. Does that name ring a bell at all?
Besides the fact that John Stewart got great mileage out of the name Abbottabad, that's, of course, where the Osama bin Laden was hiding.
Yeah, and that's just to the north by about 40 miles from the capital of Pakistan, yep. Islamabad. So that whole India, or the whole Pakistani-controlled portions of Kashmir, where we know there are a lot of separatist training camps and whatnot, and where a lot of the militants live, is really only about 40 miles to the east of Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan. So, I mean, the whole place is just, it's a tinderbox waiting to go up because of the proximity to Islamabad, right?
Right.
I mean, anything that you, any strikes you would carry out that are near the capital of another country, and your side in India and the Pakistan side are both nuclear armed. I mean, you are really gambling that you can, you know, keep control of this situation and it doesn't spin out of control and escalate beyond what anybody would want to have happen. Now, the international community has come in across the board, including our own president, and said, look, we really hope this can, you know, this satisfies both the Indian side and the Pakistani side. The Pakistanis said, we reserve the right to respond at a time and place of our choosing.
Huh.
So does Pakistan sit back and just say, okay, you know, we'll take one for the team on this and just call it a day? Or will they carry out retaliatory strikes on their own? Now, supposedly they shot down some number of Indian jets, Rafale jets made by France that India purchased. There's wreckage that was reported supposedly with French markings on it. But Pakistan also flies French-made jets.
Okay.
So is that an old jet that crashed before? I mean, who knows, right? I mean, this
right.
The high mountainous terrain, it's very hard to move around up there. It's very hard to recover survivors or bodies of, you know, people who've died. I think there's about 26 people that have been killed in these strikes. I'm sure there might be more as they dig people out of the rubble. So we'll see where this goes. It's just not good. It's not good.
No, it's
anytime
not.
Two nuclear armed countries are fighting, even in an area that's sort of like a proxy conflict for both of them in many regards.
Right.
The fact that India struck targets inside Pakistan was maybe a little bit too aggressive, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, this is going to be interesting, and hopefully it doesn't get more than interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Hey, I want to ask you, we talked yesterday with our pal Tim McNiff about some cuts that are being made in the Department of Defense to the highest ranking officials in the military, four-star generals, four-star admirals. And I had questions about that because I don't, first of all, you know, I don't expect you to know these things off the top of your head, John, but like,
okay.
Do you know how many four-star generals and admirals we have?
There are about Well, I think normally there are about 40-ish or so on duty at any given time.
Okay.
And that's spread across the chairman and vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The chairman, of course, is that Air Force three-star that was picked up, nominated by President Trump and so he actually came out of retirement to get his fourth star and serve as the chairman. That was General Kane. There's a Navy admiral who's serving as the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Chris Grady.
Okay.
Then you have each of the theater combatant commands. Those are all four-star generals or admirals, like U.S. Central Command, U.S. European Command, U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, U.S. Africa Command, etc. Those are all, you know, four-star jobs. They've been that way for a very long time. Mm-hmm. The one that's vacant right now, interestingly enough, is the commander of U.S. Cyber Command.
Oh.
That had been that Air Force four-star general that the Secretary of Defense removed, and nobody really knows why he was fired. But he was fired, and they haven't named anybody yet, as far as I know, to go in and take over that job. Now, what's critical about that job is that the person who is the commander of U.S. Cyber Command as a four-star is also dual-hatted as the director of the National Security Agency, the premier signals intelligence collection capability that we have, and the chief of the Central Security Service, which is really the military communications security and the military forces signals intelligence capability. So it's a big job. Yeah. I mean, from a national security perspective, because Commander Cyber Command is the one dealing with all of the threats to the U.S. government and U.S. military from foreign cyber operations. And it's not like those things are not happening every single second of every day.
Yeah.
So we don't have a commander in there right now. And then you have the chief of the National Guard Bureau. That used to be, I think, there was a Minnesotan in there for a while. I don't remember what the guy's name is. And then there's the vice chief. They're both four-star jobs. The vice chief is vacant right now, if I remember correctly.
Okay.
You have some sub-unified commands, like Commander United Nations Command and the commander of U.S. Forces Korea. There's a dual role there. You have the service chiefs and vice chiefs for the Army, the Air Force, Space Force, Navy, et cetera. Those are four-star jobs. And then you have major commands within the services that are four-star jobs, like Commanding General of U.S. Army Forces Command, Commanding General of U.S. Army Futures Command, Army Materiel Command, and then, you know, Commandant of the Marine Corps, you know, and the deputy or assistant commandant. On the Navy side, you have a Navy four-star admiral who is the director of naval nuclear propulsion. That guy, when he gets the job, it's an 8-year assignment.
Wow.
So they have long continuity in the reactors, Navy nuclear propulsion program, to make sure that you have continuity. You don't swapping people out every few years.
Right.
Because obviously nuclear power is a fairly critical thing to get right. You know what I mean?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So there are a lot of four-star jobs. I think within the services themselves, you could probably find a way to restructure some of those four-star positions back to a three-star job. One of the things that I saw that was concerning to me, and this is just me personally, was the idea of breaking apart, or I mean recombining, U.S. European Command with U.S. Africa Command. So you're resubordinating the theater combatant commander, who is responsible for almost all of the continent of Africa.
Yeah.
Right now that's a general Michael Langley from the Marine Corps. You would resubordinate that command back under U.S. European Command. Well, a number of years ago, we pulled Africa Command out from under European Command because we recognized you've got 54 nations and 1.1 billion people and an unbelievable amount of natural resources on the African continent.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia and China especially, are competing aggressively for influence all across the African continent. why would we not want to have a dedicated theater combatant command to work with partners all across the African continent? So I really don't understand that. I mean, Europe will always get a priority over what's happening in Africa. And if you resubordinate U.S. Africa Command under a European command, no engagement will happen with Africa, with the African continent. And I find that inconceivably stupid.
Well, I agree with you. I am going to ask your opinion on something. You don't even have to. You don't have to answer this if you don't want to. But the Secretary of Defense is on record as saying a lot of those 4-star jobs are the people who have them are more politicians than they are military commanders or military leaders, and they. A lot of, essentially, his point was a lot of them get those jobs because they sort of they're sycophants and they just sort of weasel their way to the top. Is that a fair characterization of kind of an across the board characterization of 4-star generals
and admirals? Not in my experience.
Yeah.
I mean, if you take a look at the jobs that some of these 4-stars have been appointed to. And you look at their resumes, they are wildly qualified for those positions. And they competed against a whole bunch of other people to get picked up for that 4-star to serve in, what previous administrations, previous secretaries of defense and secretaries of the services have determined, these are big, big jobs that we want to make sure we get right. And the people who've been appointed to those jobs have been career professionals committed to, defending the nation. They're experts in their areas. Could you make an argument that something like Commander Air Force Materiel Command, could that be moved down a slot to a 3-star position? I don't know. Yeah, probably you could, right?
Yeah.
Commander Air Combat Command for the Air Force, that's a 4-star job right now. Should that be a 3-star? I don't know, maybe. So it has never been my experience in the 25 years I served in the military, four in Annapolis and almost 21 on active duty. The 4-star officers that I encountered were across the board amazingly talented individuals, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Now, it is an inescapable fact of life that once you make flag or general officer in the military, there is an element of politics that inserts itself into the leadership ranks. Mm-hmm. But that's a smaller element of the overall chain of command and mission priorities that are carried out by those flag and general officers. Are you going to encounter some people who are nothing more than politicking, animals willing to knife each other in the back of the head? Well, you find that all across America, in corporate America. I mean, it just happens, right? It's human nature that some people will be like that. But the system often weeds those individuals out at the 1 or 2-star level, and they're gone. They don't make it up to a higher level. So generally speaking, the people who make it to 3 and certainly to 4-star leadership positions are very, very talented individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. I do appreciate your insight there, sir. Anything else you want to mention before we send you on your way until next week?
Nothing really comes to mind. If you have any other topics you want to bring up, I am happy to comment on it if I know anything about it.
Well, I think we've taken enough of your time today, sir.